Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is The Other Thing I Do. It's the show's 6th anniversary week, and I thought you deserved a bonus episode, so I'm bringing on Ben David Grabinski, a writer, director, and producer whose credits include the screenplay for Skip Trace and the upcoming reboot of Are You Afraid of the Dark? His first feature, happily, stars Joel McHale and Carrie Bichet as a long-married couple whose relationship runs into some profound existential challenges, and trust me, that's the understatement of the year. It co-stars a murderer's row of talented people like Natalie Z, John Daly, Natalie Morales, Shannon Woodward, Kirby Howell-Baptiste, Charlene Yee, Brecken Meyer, Stephen Root, and friend of the show, Paul Scheer. It's available on digital and on demand today, and it's really good. Ben David picked Something Wild, Jonathan Demme's wonderful 1986 fusion of screwball comedy and electrifying neo-noir. Starring Jeff Daniels as an uptight New York finance guy kidnapped for a weekend by Melanie Griffith's freewheeling Lulu. She introduces him to petty theft, handcuff sex, and eventually her entire past, which includes her volatile ex named Ray, played by Ray Liotta. With an unpredictable script by Emax Fry and an eccentric soundtrack featuring avant-garde artists like David Byrne, John Cale, and Laurie Anderson, the movie occupies a singular space in the American indie boom of the 80s. It's like a lot of them, and it's not like any of them. This is someone else's movie.
I remember very vividly, I didn't have any kind of cable growing up, and my parents didn't let me watch R-rated movies. And when I would go to my grandparents' house, every once in a while I would watch a movie on a movie channel if, like, no one was home.
Right.
The first one I ever saw, I think, was I watched Predator. Then Police Academy, which I think was the first time I saw nudity in a movie, and that was a weird experience. But the biggest thing for me was I watched Something Wild, and it was an example of me realizing that movies could do more than I thought they could. Like, it was a very big transition point for me in terms of understanding tone and stakes in movies. And like that a movie could be funny, but also something else. It made me just deeply uncomfortable when the tone switches, and we'll get into it later. But the movie takes a turn that is still exhilarating now, watching as an adult. And I've watched it a lot, especially my Criterion Blu-ray of it. But when someone said, hey, do you want to do a podcast and talk about a movie? There's a short list. And it really just got down to this and Barb and Star, and I decided to go with this. So,
I mean, both films are kind of dedicated to upending the idea of what they're supposed to be. Although Barb and Star just does it in the first frames, and Something Wild takes about an hour.
Yeah, Barb and Star also just does it in terms of in a meta overall sense, because I just don't think anyone could have had the expectations that it lived up to. I mean, because personally, I think it's a perfect movie. But let's talk about another perfect movie, Something Wild.
Sure thing. I saw it in 1986 in a theater, and it was, I'm pretty sure it was the first Demme film I'd seen in a movie theater. And I think in a way that was perfect, because even more so than Stop Making Sense, it's the film where his control becomes perfect. Every two or three pictures, he would make a movie that would show you the potential of the genre he was choosing to work in. And with Something Wild coming after things like, you know, Desperately Seeking Susan, or what was the other one I was thinking of right around that same time? There was a wave of not exactly Manic Pixie Dream Girl, but squares being loosened up by women who were unconventional, let's say, at least. And now it would be borderline, like, personality disorder at the worst. I don't know how to explain it, but what's going on in Something Wild, and I watched, like, the trailer is so instructive to see how Orion thought they were selling it in 86, where, you know, Ray Liotta pops up a couple of times, but he's mostly just laughing and smiling and being intense. You don't get any sense of what the second half of the movie is. And in the theater, it was like being shaken, like picked up and shaken. The lights go down in the shot where Liotta shows up. The tone actually gets darker. The shift is so stark and shocking.
I literally just tweeted about that when I was watching this movie is the way that the lighting changes to introduce Ray Liotta in this movie is one of the most, to me, exhilarating film choices ever, where it's like the literal lighting of the movie changes to let you know we're not in light territory anymore. And you almost might not even notice it, or you might not think it's meaningful and then still be caught off guard. But the filmmaking shifts really strongly the second he's on that dance floor.
Yeah. So much of the movie is thrown out at that point. Like, we never see Audrey's mom. We never see Peaches again. We never see most of the world that they've been, like, the bouncy. There are no more cameos. There's no more fun stuff and playful appearances by other directors that, you know, the filmmakers are throwing in to amuse themselves and the people in the know. It just gets so suddenly focused on Ray. Like, he takes over the film. And I don't think I'd seen Liotta in anything at the time. He just appeared. And it's amazing casting, but it's also,
I can't think of anybody else. He has this real live wire danger to him that even I don't think in anything else I've seen him in, he's been outside of like Hubie Halloween. I don't think he's ever been that level of scary. You know, it almost feels like it's a slow burn horror movie. You just don't know you're watching a slow burn horror movie when that shifts. And they get back to levity later and stuff. But yeah, that's just there's so much to say about the movie. But that is the entrance of Ray Liotta to me is the most significant factor of that movie, especially because it's following the most joyful moment of the whole movie, which is the dance scene, which is incredible.
Yeah.
And that is like pure cinema. It's joyful. It's so human. And then boom, the movie just punches you in the face.
Yeah. The thing that struck me this time through is how much of a screwball comedy structure it's mimicking. I mean, it's conscious, obviously. It was always supposed to do that. It's the bringing up baby thing. It's you know, the Manic Pixie thing was just the 80s, 90s innovation. It had been around for decades beforehand. But the structure of it is so much about, you know, this uptight guy who's taken over by like his tiny indiscretion. It just gets him to the radar of this incredible, liberated, sexual woman who takes him on an adventure. But it's never fun, right? Like it's charming and interesting as a filmmaking exercise, as a movie, it bounces along, but Daniels is always terrified. People are genuinely threatened with violence. We know early on, even before we're supposed to, I think, in the script, but the fact that we can hear the dial tone kicking in when he's supposed to be talking to his wife, we know Charlie's not being 100% honest with Lulu either. And it's like, it's Demi just constantly calling attention to all the things that have to work in a screwball comedy and just taking them away one by one. Like he's pulling out straws in the Jenga or whatever. No, I'm mixing metaphors on board games, but you know what I mean? Like it's just this constant denial to the audience of the thing that we think we want from a screwball comedy. And then when the violence comes, it has real consequences. Like every moral transgression is punished on some level.
Well, it's like everything besides the drunk driving is kind of fun until it goes wrong. Mm-hmm. But the issue is it's hard for you to remember on repeat viewings what your feeling was on your first viewing, because you bring with it on later viewings the knowledge of what's to come.
Right.
Whereas it could feel like she's just a wild card personality that's keeping you off kilter. But it's really interesting because they're both fucked up people. Like he's in denial about who he is and hasn't really mourned the loss of like his family life and what he thought his future would be. And she's broken and doesn't want a relationship and is like trying to take advantage of the fact that he's married and thinks he's not going to be interested. Like there's layers to their characters in terms of their, what they want, what the lies they're telling themselves, and all these things. It just feels very, fleshed out with a lot of it being like subtext. It's just like someone recognizing that this guy wants to do these things, but it's like, but why does he want to steal shit? Why does he want to do this stuff? It's because he's in pain, you know?
Right.
And the fact that you can juggle all those different thoughts next to what otherwise would have been just this kind of lark of a comedy. Like I could see another director saying, we need to change the last 30 pages of this script and we need to do this. And it could have become that, but all Jonathan Demme's movies feel fearless. Almost every single one of them has an element that would have scared someone else away, you know?
Yeah.
Like even comedies or even movies that are like everything he's done, almost everything he's done has like some sort of idiosyncratic, risky kind of thing to it. But he always nails it.
Yeah, the confidence that a movie like this must take, not just to make it, but to get it made, to pitch it. Because at the time, people weren't looking for this sort of thing. No one was interested in genre bending anything in 1986. I mean, this was the Reagan Revolution. Charlie was clearly supposed to be a regular hero. Like, there's a version of this film where he simply gets Lulu back and wins without any of the danger to himself. He's a Michael J. Fox character who shows up in something and wins easily. But the fact that you know, his nose gets broken early on and then the makeup just keeps tracking. It's an ugly, unpleasant situation. He fears for his life more than once. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's like, Jeff Daniels can play the comedy of running around in the Virginia's for Lovers t-shirt and the shorts, but there's still danger because we've just watched a man pull his ex-wife or his estranged wife through a bathroom window because she was trying to escape from him because he's a violent maniac. And it never lets you forget that. Like, Ray is genuinely dangerous even when he's not doing anything. Like, he's a constant state of threat.
I'm really curious if on the page, maybe some of the people who made it weren't reading that stuff as dark as it was, or maybe weren't expecting that execution. But that's the thing. It's like, Demme doesn't show the audience and Stop Making Sense, which is my second favorite movie of all time. And like, that is a crazy fucking concept, but it's brilliant because when you watch Stop Making Sense and then you finally see the audience in the last number, it has this like crescendo effect.
Yeah.
He's just that guy. If you had to write down like every good choice he made making a movie, you'd write like 4 books, like from casting to music. Like, I mean, the music in this movie is still so great and so like eclectic. And it just shows like such an interest in like just like music from other countries or like from like cultural stuff that hadn't gone super mainstream yet. Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to remember if David Byrne's Ray Momo had come out by then, if his Luwak Bop had started as a record label, because I was really into Talking Heads in the 80s, and Something Wild was, I might have been like the second or third soundtrack I ever bought on CD, because they were that fresh, and it was, I just wanted that Wild Thing. I wanted both of those Wild Thing covers, the Byrne and Celia Cruz one from the beginning and the Sister Carol version at the end, because
man, that bit at the end when they
go out on such a high, right,
singing, it's god. You can like feel like Demme's love and appreciation for stuff in the movies. Like, you can just, that just feels like someone's like, isn't this the best? There's something just about the vibe of that where it's someone being like, this is the best way to end a movie. Like, why don't all movies end this way? Yeah. Every movie should end with people dancing or singing, regardless of what happened before the ending.
Yeah. I mean, it absolutely, given how weird and ambiguous that ending should be, that they're going off together into an unknown future, finally seeing each other for who they are, but almost certainly doomed. You don't think about it at all. You just,
yeah, because your thought is, hey, at least there's music.
Yeah,
like
the
score, know,
the soundtrack is just so lively.
I love how New York feels in the movie, but I also love how cities feel in all of his movies. Like, you know, Silence of the Lambs, every location and town and house, you just, it feels so lived in. And that's also another thing too. It's like the apartments and houses and this, even the one that's like empty from his family leaving, it just feels so raw and real. It feels like there's like a history there. There's just like a lot of just really good choices is basically my feeling about Jonathan Demme and his movies. I haven't said that yet. He made good choices.
I think it's a given. After Hours, that's the other one. The other one that this is not is that was another manic pixie kind of thing with, you know, Griffin Dunne being lured into Soho by Rosanna Arquette.
Yeah, and but then she like dies before you could really like say it's too much that it's like. Yeah.
Then he's surrounded by other manic pixies.
The other movie that I saw when I was younger that I liked in the same way, but I don't think holds up scene to scene, is Into the Night. Into the Night, I love it, but in terms of its like episodic nature, some of the sequences work better than others. And when you're in an episodic movie, you kind of live or die on that consistency. But Into the Night, like I grew up crazy into John Landis movies, even though I didn't necessarily know it, because I watched Blues Brothers like 100 times as a kid, and I love Trading Places, and I love Spies Like Us, but Into the Night, I recorded off a TV, like the edited version, which isn't, I didn't watch it until again when I was an adult. And I was like, there's a lot of nudity in this. And why am I watching it on an airplane? Because I had it on my laptop. And I remember very vividly being like, oh, oops. But Into the Night, though, does have this incredible thing where like the opening section of the movie really captures the insomniac point of view that Jeff Goldblum has, where the editing and the rhythm of it really makes you feel like you're up at 4 a.m. and cannot go to sleep and everything feels a little delirious. But After Hours and Something Wild to me are both like top tier. Like, but Something Wild is something that is, that's more because of the shift in it. Like After Hours from frame one has the danger and the dark humor and the other stuff, but Something Wild, you know, as we've discussed ad nauseum, it makes choices and big shifts all at once after you've gotten really settled in. It's just like if you're on a plane and 2/3 through the flight, you find out that the pilot's hammered. Like, there's just something.
Yeah.
It's just like you're like, I feel safe. Now I don't. I don't.
Yeah.
You really feel like everyone could die.
Yeah. Well, the movies that destabilize while still feeling like they're in control, I think, are the most insidious in the way they affect an audience. Because I remember the tone of the film just rolling through the crowd that I was with. It was like an opening weekend screening at a shoebox theater in Toronto called the Canada Square. This whole room was like, oh, what's going to happen next? What's going to happen next? And you could feel everyone clench up. And it was just this incredible sensation. Sorry, I've been trying to remember not to completely write off Daniels and Griffith and what they do for both the comedy and the drama of it, because they have to build those characters up as believable even when they're doing preposterous things. Like Daniels has this, they both underplayed beautifully, and subsequent work from Melanie Griffith, I think, suggests that she is best when she's being underestimated by the audience as well as the in-universe characters, where you think, oh, I don't, like, shouldn't she be bigger? And then the more I realize, like, her kind of calm, quiet line readings are way more interesting in the second half, because we understand why she's keeping so much of herself lowered and quiet and measured.
Well, if their performances weren't fine-tuned in that section, the threat and the reality that seeps in wouldn't work. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't realize how much you're watching kind of these raw performances that are not, the scenes aren't built like to lead to a punchline where like Jeff Daniels is like really like reaching for the back row. It has a very like character study vibe. Just there's like heightened things happening because he's with someone who's this reckless and he's being reckless, but it feels just natural in a way. Like they feel very like these are people that exist. And these are the type of characters that could really feel the opposite. And it's part casting and just part, you know, everyone involved understanding what they were trying to make. But yeah, the two of them are just really interesting. And it's, and I also just love how she's kind of using him to show her parents that she's normal, and he's using her to feel like he's not normal. And like the fact that those two things can coexist at the same time, it's just, it could be really messy, but instead it's just, there's a lot of layers to things.
And it's endlessly rewatchable. I mean,
it's crazily rewatchable.
I've lost track of how many times I've seen it. It's been a while. I don't think I've seen it since the Blu-ray first came out, the Criterion Edition. But we got to revisit it last night, I got to revisit it last night. My wife, Kate, has never seen it. And it was just really fascinating, just sort of glancing over every few minutes and just watching her try to figure out what to do with it, because it's slippery as hell. And part of that too is listening to it through this time, most of the dialogue seems to have been recorded live. It doesn't sound like it's been looped. It's got that kind of low budget 80s road movie feel to it where they're just catching what they can. A lot of the scenes in the car are overwhelmed by Lulu's radio, and it feels wrong in a lot of ways. Like, it's just not as slick as a movie like this is supposed to be, which I think is another way of setting us up for the twist and just showing us that, you know, oh, here's a scene where the straight-laced guy gets liberated because he's forced to wear a new suit and it looks good on him and he's getting a little more confident, and that sets up the dancing scene. But it also has this sort of threadbare feel to it, the fact that they go to a thrift shop instead of someplace fancy, and that there's no scam involved, that it's just Lulu honestly trying to help him briefly. And I also realize I'm still calling her Lulu instead of Audrey, which I think, you know, like, that's the name she prefers in this circumstance.
Well, look, I mean, if we could get her here now to tell us what we should do, otherwise, I think it's a safe mistake.
Yeah. Well, but I think it's also her way of disconnecting herself from her marriage to Ray, right? Like, she's a completely different person for Charlie.
Yeah. There's just so much interesting writing stuff going on there. And then also just, again, the filmmaking and the locations and the sound and the music all feels very like tactile. It doesn't feel like there's any sound stages in the movie. Mm-hmm. Even though, you know, there could be. Even though I've made stuff and been on tons of sets and I can tell the difference between a back lot and a street and whatever, there may be some stealthy sets in this movie, but it mostly seems like a location movie. It mostly seems like real apartments, real restaurants. I don't know where the reunion dance was. Maybe that's a stage, maybe it's not, but if they're all locations, they're all picked really well. Also like the hotel too, where you can like see in from far away. So like you can see him in there when he's like using the employee and then coming through the door. It has a very like voyeuristic kind of vibe to it. But it all does feel like this is a real world where the quirk, like if you'd made the movie kind of like twee, which I don't even know if I actually know what twee means, but if you leaned into the quirkiness and like shot it with a bunch of wide angle lenses and made it feel kind of false, the turn wouldn't work at all. It would just feel like, you know, I mean, my style of filmmaking is less reality based than this one. But if I was making a movie like this, I'd have to adjust, because otherwise Ray would feel like a cartoon. And instead, Ray just feels like the devil.
Yeah. Yeah. He trying to figure out how to frame this. Leota has this quality of glee, even when he's shown up, even when Charlie tricks him into, you know, or doesn't even trick him. He uses the police in the diner to leave with Audrey. Ray admires him. Like, I'm finally starting to like you, things like that, where he's enjoying the chaos that he brings to other people. And I think like we never see him take a punch. We never see him go down. Charlie never gets the drop on him physically until the very end. And even then it's an accident, but he's just so confident and so present.
Yeah. He's behaving as if he's safe doing this to these people, that he's indestructible because he doesn't give a shit. And that is a scary thing for a guy, you know. When you say glee and you think, but I also think of like in Goodfellas, there's a lot of moments of him laughing or enjoying things that are borderline sadism. But the way he does it in that movie, I mean, that's just the brilliance of Goodfellas, is like that you can go from him in this, where if this is the only time I'd seen him, I'm like, there's no way I would empathize with this guy as a gangster or want to be him. And you're like so quickly with him in Goodfellas, even though like they're terrible people. Those two things, because they're back to back, right? Didn't he do Goodfellas like after
4 years between the two?
Yeah, it's, but like,
they're pretty close.
That feels like
they, like the 1-2 punch of those two things, like if you had never seen anything else he'd ever been and you just saw those two, you'd be like, that guy's one of like the biggest actors ever, right? Like it'd feel like that, because being able to carry Goodfellas and then carrying the second half of this movie, you can't do that unless you got the goods.
Oh yeah. He's great. And he has this, it's his eyes, you know, it's the fact that he always looks like he's wearing eyeliner, even though he isn't. He just has this intensity and the contrast between his eyes and the rest of his face, where you just, like, I keep wanting to look at the smile. It's one of those things where I hate using the Joker as an example because it's been beaten to death, and I have seen the new Justice League and that should stop. But I guess the other thing I wanted to ask before we segue into Happily is the challenge of not spoiling a film like this. And obviously it's been 35 years. We can talk about whatever we want. It's in the Criterion Collection. It's taken very seriously, and rightly so. But it was, I remember at the time that people would ask me if they should go. And I was like, yeah, you should absolutely go. And they would say, like, how funny is it? Is it a real comedy? And I was like, well, and I realized this is maybe the first time I wanted to protect a movie. I didn't want to give anything away. I have this policy now as a reviewer. If it happens after the first 20 minutes, I really don't like to talk about it. The first reel should be set up and you can talk about premise and things like that. But I really don't like revealing twists. But then to talk about this, you wouldn't even be able to discuss Ray Liotta's character. And I found myself so ferociously protecting the film. I was in high school. It was a really like a watershed moment for me in my development of, you know, fighting for pieces of art. And no one could understand it because it looked like this disposable little comedy. It's like, no, it's really good. I don't want to tell you anything about it. Just go see it.
I mean, that's like literally my life right now, because how do you sell Happily without ruining where it's going? Because most of the enjoyment of the movie to me is contingent upon not knowing. Because then
I was going to say,
it takes a lot of, every time you think it's going to zig, it's going to zag. And like, but you also don't even want people to know that, you know, it's like, that's like the trickiest thing. It's like what I settled on for this is like, you know, I like the trailer for Happily shows everything and also nothing. But what it does do is it doesn't hide the weirdness. And I think with something like this, it's like you need to have an element of danger there, but not to necessarily the extent that's there. Mm-hmm. Because it's like, you need, like, if people see a trailer that is so different from what they saw, it has to be like a masterpiece in a different direction. The only time in modern movies where I think an ad campaign still worked, even though it was dishonest, was Inglourious Basterds, because the movie is so fucking good. But every TV spot and every trailer was like exciting music of Jews killing Nazis. And it sort of felt like the whole movie was just going to be that. And they, you know, they're not even really the central focus of the movie. How do you do a trailer for that movie that says this is about two completely different plot threads leading to someone trying to kill Hitler? You don't want to say that. And you'd also don't want to be like, half the movie's about this girl who loves movies and is hanging out with a Nazi but pretending to like him so she can have a screening of a movie. But the reality is that movie is so fucking good. People were like hooked from the opening scene, and no one's like, I thought the Bastards were going to be in more of this. And to be fair, if they said that, they're just, you know, they're bad taste. But that's, you know, marketing is a really tricky thing, especially because like I have a 2-stage thing of like the plot with mine, which is like, well, the plot is initially it's about a married couple who realizes that all their friends resent them and hate them, and they were oblivious to it. But then it's another thing, and then a third thing. And by design, it's exactly what I wanted to make, but it doesn't fit into sort of a traditional, you know, because like when you, like a trailer for a movie is like, here's the plot, everything from the 15-minute mark to the end is sort of the same journey. But in this case, it's not. And Something Wild is the same way, because it's not. Because the movie is like, oh, this guy who's a straight-laced person is going to hang out with this wild card personality and they're going to get into some trouble, but actually real trouble, and he might die. Like, you know, that's like a whole shift of like explanation. But I think also just, and this might be too in the weeds, but I think as long as your materials don't hide that something you're doing has like craft and thought to it. Because like if you simplify something and make it seem like it's just a comedy or something is just this thing, then people are also going to be annoyed. I mean, my favorite audience being annoyed thing ever was being at Punch Drunk Love opening night, Ames, Iowa, and everyone in the theater walked out except me. And that because everyone was just like, there was no context for a non-Happy Madison Adam Sandler movie. Yeah. And the movie was like heaven to me, and it's still like in my top five of all time. But man, going to see a movie where you're like, this is a religious experience, and everyone else has walked out. But if you go back and watch the trailers for Punch Drunk Love, they're like screaming, this is a weird art movie. And but people, it was so coded as not because of Adam Sandler that they're just like, yeah, let's go see this. It just looks like a well-shot Adam Sandler movie. And it's just a totally different thing.
Yeah. I mean, the best jokes aren't in the trailer for a change, right? You just trick yourself into thinking it's the thing you want to see.
There's nothing better than seeing a movie that all the good jokes are in the movie and you didn't know. Like Barb and Star. This is the last time I'm bringing back Barb.
No, it's fine. I honestly, the best joke in Barb and Star to me is the revelation of the villain's name, which is never spoken aloud.
But oh my God. But I mean, yeah, but I feel like everything is almost second to Trish, but there's a lot of levels to the jokes, or like just the payoff of the suicide drink, where later the antidote is like the iced tea.
Lemon it's infused a pretty iced dense tea.
Screenplay. I've only seen it 4.5 times. I'm not even kidding.
I have watched it once, but I did grab Edgar's Prayer on YouTube and have watched that on a loop about 5 times a day.
Man, some people want to be official couples. Speaking of official couples, happily not.
Well, I do want to talk about happily a little bit because this is going to be out of sequence for listeners, but I did an episode with Bria Grant 2-3 weeks ago. We were talking about the film itself and the tone, and the thing that amazed me the most about it was realizing maybe 45 minutes in that you had managed to do, like, you've made a better version of The Box than Richard Kelly did, but it sounds insulting to him, and that's not what I mean either. There's this free-floating anxiety that he deals with so well, and your film finds the same uneasy energy of people who aren't sure that they can trust either themselves or the world around them, and just the idea that the floor keeps sliding out from under everyone over the course of the movie, I found that absolutely exhilarating, because that never lands. It never gets all the way to the end, and you managed it. Your film actually does that, and Something Wild does it too, which is why it makes perfect sense that we're talking about it.
Well, I can't speak to the extent that it works or not. All I know is I love it, and it's what I wanted to do. But my intention for Happily was that the structure doesn't necessarily come from the traditional like A, B, C, D, E thing. It's more like the structure comes from pulling the audience in and making them question where they're at as a viewer, where the characters are. And just when they feel like they have it handled, to do that again and to just keep sort of pulling with that type of thematic momentum it's just like every time someone might start to settle and be like, I know what this is. I let them know that they don't. And then that never really stops until I think the post-credit sequence, really, because without saying too much, it's like this type of movie could end with everybody getting killed or with, you know, a reveal pushing it into a different genre than it's in. There's a lot of different ways it could go. And I was really just trying to navigate that in terms of your just point of view as an audience. And I still, hopefully the trailer doesn't fuck that up too much. I don't think it does. Did you watch the movie before or after seeing the trailer?
Beforehand. I try to avoid stuff like trailers, marketing, everything until I have seen a film. I try to see stuff as cold as I can.
It's funny because, like, people are going to hate when I say this because it's not a good selling tool, but it's not one genre at all. And at times it can be a bunch, and at times it can just be one. But to me, I do think it like all organically feels right for the story I'm telling. But again, it's like, if you're going to make a movie for not a lot of money, my feeling is you should make something personal and specific. And a lot of smaller movies to me feel like they're trying to make a studio movie without being greenlit by a studio or without studio financing. So they're trying to make, you know, like a Nora Ephron movie for $5. And part of the appeal of Nora Ephron movies is that they are big, slick kind of studio things. Yeah. And for me, it's like, if I'm going to make a small movie, I might as well try to get away with something, you know, as opposed to making it very down the middle. Does any of that make sense?
It does. Yeah. I mean, we see a lot of calling cards just because people want to immediately launch themselves into bigger stuff. So you either get high concept movies that don't take risks, that just do the concept, or you get wild swings that more often than not exceed their like budget, really, like literally can't handle the ideas that they're throwing around. Also because now we are in this wave of indies that are trying to be dystopian surveillance movies. It means that people just think all they need is crappy video, and that doesn't work exactly either. I've seen four of them in the last 2 months and they're exhausting. But films that take an idea and run with it, and at least, well, I mean, the way Happily employs music, that the your soundtrack selections are just a way of sort of taking my hand and saying, I have a sense of what I want to do with this. And you're referencing other work in a way that I found really, it's confident. It's confident on the filmmaking part, but it's reassuring to me as a viewer that you know what you're doing. Like whether or not it's going to go somewhere I'm going to like or appreciate, there is a sense of a vision here. Like the movie, I've said this a couple of times recently in watching stuff, is like, you have to trust the film and until it shows you, you can't trust it. And Happily is a movie that plays fair with the viewer, even if it doesn't play necessarily fair with the characters, which I always, you know, I have to respect that. That's a sign that the director is in charge, that you're not just ticking off lines on a box. You're telling a story in a straight line the way you want to tell it.
Well, again, I can't speak to whether or not I'm successful in what I'm about to say, but my feeling when you watch a movie is sometimes you watch a movie and very quickly feel like, I don't feel comfortable here. I don't know if they really have a clear vision of where this is heading. In the metaphor I always say, or analogy, whatever the word is, sometimes you get in an Uber and you want to tell the driver, hey, make a left on this street and go here. But then sometimes you get the vibe immediately that like they know what they're doing and you can just relax and look at your phone. And I wanted to make a movie where you sort of feel like the driver knows the best route to get where you're going. Like you want to feel like, okay, I can just relax and just let this movie happen. I think a lot of that comes from just sort of kind of specificity, you know, in terms of tone or visuals or sound or music or performances, or feeling like all of them are working in context of each other, you know, because like sometimes you can watch a movie and like there's a bad needle drop and someone feels like they're miscast, and you're not sure how you're supposed to feel about a scene. And then you're like, it's hard to like sort of recover.
Yeah.
And hopefully that's not an issue I have with this, because my intention was really to make it feel like there was sort of a steady hand the whole time. Like where even if you don't like the movie, I feel like you could walk away being like, well, that guy definitely made some choices.
Yeah. I think that's the tension I'm talking about. And it, yeah, again, it puts me in mind of Something Wild, where you can watch it as a perfectly satisfying romp. And if you really still insist, even in the second half, you could probably convince yourself that it's still a comedy, right? Like just the way they ditch Margaret Cullen. And that's Margaret Cullen. I'd completely forgotten she was in this. I never remember her every time. It's just like, oh, that's great. She shows up and is never like, they leave her at the buying cigarettes and we never see her again. And she probably has a fun story to tell the next week, but it's also,
well, that's
clear.
Actually a thing, not to cut you off, remember where you were, that Jonathan Demme talks about on the Blu-ray that I will never forget. And I thought of it when I made Happily, is that you have to cast every character so that like once they show up, that's all you're paying attention to, even if they're only there for 10 seconds.
Yeah.
In every part in Something Wild, even like a cop on the side of the road, you're like if that person came back, you'd be like, oh, great. Like that person was so interesting and well cast. Or, you know, if there's like some guy from a band working in a convenience store, you're just like, oh, that person really pops. And like for her, it's like she has so much presence and then is gone. But that, I think, just speaks to the quality of the movie, you know? Yeah.
And in her one scene where she gets to talk to Audrey in the convenience store, we see that she's just as afraid of Ray as Audrey is, which is such a great little detail that she's even more helpless and swept up in this dangerous moment, but she gets out. And then who's the other person I was thinking of too, is the, it's Larry's wife. It's either Pam or Peg who is pregnant.
Oh, and so good. I love her tiny little acting moments. Just there's so much history between them.
Yeah.
And it's hilarious too, because Audrey or Lula or whatever, it's like, maybe that's a character I wouldn't have liked if I was following her in high school. All I know is I like who she is now. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, there's so much, like, I love movies that leave something to you. It's like, there's stuff I want to say about the Bad Happy that I don't want to spoil, which is a bummer, because like, there's some intention stuff where like, I just don't want to say, because if I do, then you're going to kind of know where everything's going, even if I'm being vague.
No, I understand.
Yeah, you know, Demi is obviously a huge inspiration for me. I mean, this movie is a sum total of so many different influences and directors I like, but Something Wild is like one of those things that really changed my entire concept of like what movies can be, and definitely would lead to this, because I feel like if movies can be that bold and work, then we should usually aim for that. And it's easier said than done, especially when there's more cooks in the kitchen. I mean, like when I made this movie, I had no adult supervision. and it was like, I just got to make my own harebrained, insane movie. But then the more money you have and the more people around, the more people can be like, I don't know. Do we really think he should be this dangerous? What if the audience doesn't like that? Or like, do we really want to use this song? What the audience hasn't seen Streets of Fire? You're like, well, that's not the point. Like, well, that's like, you know, my music choices, I think, work if you've never heard the songs before. But then if you've heard them before or know what they're from, there's just like added layers to the movie. There's just a lot of stuff like that. Like, it's not a coincidence that the love theme sounds like the Blade Runner theme. There's a lot of weird choices that the movie just has a ton of different kind of layers of stuff where, like, if for some reason you want to watch this movie more than once, I think it would be rewarding. You don't have to. Personally, I'd just be happy if everybody rented it one time or everyone went to if there was a theater near them that was safe, they went to that. But it is a movie that I think will play different with you on repeat viewings or as time goes by. And it's also designed to feel different if you're like 22 and never had a serious relationship, or you're 40 and on your second marriage. I think the movie, also as a product of like what you project onto it about your own feelings about stuff like that. Where like, I think, you know, two different people could sit next to each other in a theater, if such a thing still existed, and walk out and like it, but for completely different reasons, and argue about it. Like, that would be the dream.
My thanks to Ben David Grabinski, whose rather unquantifiable first feature Happily is available on VOD today. You're going to want to watch it. Thanks also to Nastasia Moreau. She knows what she did. You can find Ben David on Twitter at BD Grabinski, all one word, and you can find Something Wild on Blu-ray and DVD from the Criterion Collection. It's also available to stream for free on Hoopla in the US and Canada. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at nowtoronto.com, where I'm hosting a bunch of podcasts these days and writing the weekly Now Streaming Letter, to which you can subscribe at nowtoronto.substack.com. New one comes out tomorrow. And you can find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at someoneelsesmovie.com. Our theme song is by The Last Year. If you like it or the show in general, please say so. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or wherever you've been enjoying us. And check out the other shows on the Frequency Podcast Network while you're there. Stay inside, watch movies, wear a mask if you go out. I'll see you next time.